Right, well, amazingly quiet. We'll get started straight away. I'm Christine Chinkin. I'm Professor of International Law at the London School of Economics. And first of all, I'd like to welcome everybody on behalf of the Department of Law and our sponsors for the evening. And looking forward very much to what is the third in a series of public discussions, lectures, on issues around the rule of law. And the sort of inspiring motivation behind this is very much that perhaps the rule of law has become, as a concept, has become eclipsed by the sort of newer language of human rights. And so a desire to explore the relationship between the rule of law and human rights, in particular from the understanding that without the support of the institutions maintaining the rule of law, human rights themselves are not going to be satisfactorily guaranteed or upheld in any society. And so these particular set of lectures are really looking at the various institutions within our own society and how they are supporting the rule of law and therefore contributing to the guarantee of human rights. So this week we are looking particularly at the relationship between the judiciary, human rights, and the rule of law, and have the somewhat challenging title of changing the rules in the context of those three institutions. So what we have are two absolutely outstanding speakers that we are extremely grateful for them to coming and very lucky to have got them. Roger Smith, who is going to kick off and who will give the main presentation on, as I said, changing the rules, judiciary, human rights, and the rule of law. And then Baroness Hale, who will be the commentator on Roger Smith's presentation. So it's a very brief introduction to you both. Roger Smith is a solicitor, director of justice, formerly director of the Legal Action Group, and a solicitor to the Child Poverty Action Group, and director of West Hampstead Community Law Centre. Baroness Hale, of course, is a law lord, and, of course, the first and only woman member of the Judicial House of Lords. So, again, delighted to have you both here. Roger is going to speak for about 40, 45 minutes, and then Baroness Hale follow from that, and then it'll be open to questions. So, Roger.
Thank you. This is the third, as Christine has said, of four lectures on the rule of law organised by Professor Cranston. The series is an association with justice, and I want to reflect on the concept from the viewpoint of an organisation that consciously espouses a mission statement of advancing access to justice, human rights, and the rule of law. I take my title, Changing the Rules, of course, from the Prime Minister's press conference speech, in which he noted the 2001 Terrorism Act had been, as he put it, declared partially invalid by the courts, but that the mood is now different after the bombings in last July and the rules of the game are changing. I have deleted "of the game." I don't think they're serious enough. In saying this, he simultaneously appeared to be addressing two rather different audiences, aspiring jihadis and sitting judges. He envisaged court challenge to a policy of agreeing diplomatic assurances to allow the return of detainees to countries suspected of human rights abuse. In the event of losing, he announced that we will legislate further, including, if necessary, amending the Human Rights Act in respect to the European Convention of Human Rights. It is somewhat unclear, since national legislation could not affect the UK's obligations under the Convention itself, quite how such an amendment could prove satisfactorily sustained once a case reached the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. However, Mr. Blair's statement is a reminder of the instability of the current constitutional balance. The difficult and specific issue of terrorism I am only going to refer to, that is the subject of the last lecture in this series, to be given by Shami Chakrabarty, I think next week. I want to examine how the rules governing the constitutional relationship between the different branches of the government are already changing in the process of change, where they might end up. I face the daunting challenge of being followed by Lady Hale, who reflects three judicial attributes which will become statutory once the relevant provisions of the Constitutional Reform Act come into force: merit, good character, so far as I'm aware, and diversity. And I hope that our different perspectives on this subject will provide you with an interesting evening. The rule of law was, of course, famously one of Dicey's twin pillars to the Constitution. The other was parliamentary sovereignty. His perception of the rule of law was expressly articulated in relation to the role of a parliament, which, in his view, has, under the English Constitution, the right to make any law whatever, and further, no person or body is recognised by the law of England as having a right to override and set aside the legislation of Parliament. I follow Lord Goldsmith's rather wise approach last week in avoiding a definition of the rule of law. It's easier perhaps to describe its attributes than give it a definition. And I agree with him that the courts are only its guardians of last resort, and the executive and indeed the legislature have a logically prior role in upholding it. I also agree with Lord Goldsmith, and I thought his speech was actually rather good last week, that rule of law is not just rule by law. The concept implies more than a set of technical principles. In the Attorney General's own words, it comprehends some statement of values which are universal and ought to be respected as the basis of free society. For Dicey, by contrast, lack of universality was actually precisely the point. He saw the rule of law as a distinctively English phenomenon to be contrasted with foreign practice, and he was quite happy to quote Voltaire's wonder in arriving at Dover that he had, and this is Dicey, there's a quote on Voltaire, he had passed out of the realm of despotism to a land where the laws might be harsh, but where men were ruled by law and not by caprice. Echoes of such Europhobic disdain might still be identified in some of the contemporary political resistance to notions of human rights as a dangerous continental influence. The Constitutional Reform Act offers no helpful definitions of the rule of law, but deploys it in a negative formulation, saying that the Act does not, and this is a quote, adversely affect A, the existing constitutional principle of the rule of law, and B, the Lord Chancellor's existing constitutional role in relation to that principle. The effect of the first assertion may be uncertain, since there's no definition. The second surely cannot actually be correct. The whole point of that Act was significantly to change the Lord Chancellor's existing constitutional role. For a start, postholders will cease to be judges. Regardless of such cavils, the website of the Department of Constitutional Affairs now proudly proclaims, if you consult it, we are responsible for upholding the rule of law. It is not alone. This is quite a popular mission statement. Promotion of the rule of law is an explicit objective of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, to be found in its strategic objectives, and indeed is an objective of the US State Department. You may well have heard of shock and law as a US policy. It is often misheard. Indeed, adherence to the rule of law as a settled general principle of the UK government, and if not all states, adherence to the rule of law is a settled general principle of the UK government, and if not of all states, all that claim to be liberal democracies. As Lord Steyne put it in a judgment, the UK Parliament does not operate in a vacuum. Parliament legislates for European liberal democracy based upon the traditions of the common law, and unless there is the clearest provision to the contrary, Parliament must be presumed not to legislate contrary to the rule of law. I take the implicit question behind this series of lectures, reasonably proposed by Ross Cranstoun, a former member of the legislature and the executive, to be whether changes are happening within or challenges occurring to the meaning of the rule of law within contemporary Britain. It would be surprising if we could detect neither. After all, Tony Blair announced to his first party conference in 1994 that we are putting forward the biggest programme of change to democracy ever proposed by a political party. I disown Professor Geertie's view that the Labour Party was only doing that because it was accepting spending limits and could pass no other legislation in its first 2 years. I think it was a deeper commitment to constitutional change. But that commitment to constitutional change in its first administration was remarkable. As Lord Bingham remarked with characteristic dryness later, to have enacted 11 statutes of constitutional significance, in some cases major significance, in the first legislative session of a new parliament is indeed a striking record, an exercise on which perhaps only a fresh and energetic government, unconstrained by long experience of office, would ever have embarked. Nor was the constitutional reform limited to the first session. Much time in Labour's second administration was occupied by the Constitutional Reform Act 2005, which actually began its progress much earlier. That Act and the Human Rights Act 98 undoubtedly changed the balance of powers within our Constitution. Both Acts may, however, have had unbalancing and unexpected side effects that we should explore. The Human Rights Act sought to provide mechanisms that incorporated the European Convention of Human Rights into domestic law but preserved parliamentary sovereignty. It provided a balance between a judicial duty to construe compatibly, so far as is possible, with the Convention, and if not, the duty to make a declaration of incompatibility. Lord Irvine effectively argued that that amounted to no more than a rearrangement of the pieces on the existing constitutional checkerboard in providing a modern reconciliation of the inevitable tension between the democratic right of the majority to exercise powers and the democratic need of the individual and minorities to have those human rights secured. That reconciliation has perhaps gone a little further than Lord Irvine admitted at the time, and that's what I want to explore. But I want to begin with another question. Whether the statutory framework of the Constitutional Reform Act, explicitly designed to uphold the continued independence of the judiciary, which is a quote from it, will not only continue and to uphold that independence, but will also begin to develop for the judiciary a new constitutional identity. Hitherto, we are used to a relationship between judges and government that has been close. Lord Schuster, permanent secretary of the Lord Chancellor's department in the interwar years, called his department some kind of link or buffer between government and judiciary. His successor, Sir Albert Napier, thought of it as a form of constitutional hinge. The Constitutional Reform Act formally breaks that close relationship, based as it was on the particular combination of roles formally undertaken by the Lord Chancellor, judge, minister, legislature. The Lord Chancellor loses his role as the head of the judiciary on the 3rd of April 2006 and retains only very limited vestiges of judicial appointment for a further year thereafter. He will no longer be required by convention, like Lord Faulkner and his immediate predecessors, to have had a career as a distinguished lawyer. Indeed, the statutory qualifications for the postholder require only experience as a minister, member of either House of Parliament, certain types of lawyer, legal academic, or, and I can't imagine how legislators really let this through so easily, such other experience that the Prime Minister considers relevant. A rumour that I encountered from Tory sources circulating before the last election had it that Mr Blunkett, Mr Blunkett was lined up for the post, and he would have indeed qualified under the Act, probably under more than one head. Lord Wolfe, who gave the first lecture in this series, has revealed that he still has real concerns for the future on precisely this ground, because, and this is his quote, the government has made no secret of the fact that in future the Secretary of State for Constitutional Affairs is likely to be a member of the Commons and could well be a non-lawyer. In considering the effects of the Act, it is necessary to assume that this will eventually be its result. Within a short time, we are likely to have a Lord Chancellor lacking any natural affinity with the lawyers and judges with whom he or she will need to interact. In looking for a similar type of relationship, I think it's going to be like that between the Secretary of State for Health and the General Medical Council. We need to think through the consequences of that. It's not a bad thing, but it needs to be thought about. Exchange between judiciary and executive is likely to be much more formal. This is entirely proper, but we might note the magnitude of the informal role that was actually played, helpfully, by Lord Wolfe in relation to the Constitutional Reform Act itself. It's entirely arguable that without his lengthy concordat, 147 paragraphs, with Lord Faulkner, without that outflanking the opposition, that bill might have not emerged for even longer and might have fallen. And that wasn't all. Lord Wolfe, in a previous lecture, has given an interesting account of his informal liaison with ministers. It gives us an idea of the interaction between a serving judge, senior judge, and the executive. Thus, he tells us, he saw off a Home Office proposal to take over the Magistrates' Court, on which it was not appreciated within government that it was inappropriate. He impressed on government the constitutional importance of their judiciary proposals, in which he said rather sadly, it was apparently seen by government as a reform capable of being achieved by press release. He indicated that judiciary were extremely concerned at attempts to oust their jurisdiction and asylum matters, lamenting apparently this was of little concern. It was actually amended in the final legislation. A level of informal contact will no doubt continue, but will become less easy to assume. A future Lord Wolfe will be put in a much more public position. From April, the Lord Chief Justice will become the President of the Courts of England and Wales. Lord Wolfe's successor, Lord Phillips, will become statutorily responsible for representing the views of the judiciary of England and Wales to Parliament, the Lord Chancellor, and to ministers of the Crown generally. And in doing that, performing that function, he may lay before Parliament written representations on matters that appear to him to be matters of importance relating to the judiciary or otherwise to the administration of justice. That makes him a very much more visible and thereby exposed person than any previous holder of the office. He will have a staff of between 60 and 70 people with, it seems in the modern fashion, at least 6 press officers. When combined with the effect of a Supreme Court transferred to a new building across Parliament Square from the Houses of Parliament, the separation of the judiciary and the executive will be much more apparent. Processes that are now hidden and informal will become much more formal and public. What's more, the President will be at the apex of a formal consultative and collaborative mechanism in the form of a judges' council and a new judicial executive board. The judges' council sounds a fairly anodyne beast, but let us remember how it roared onto the political scene in 1990 to express horror at Lord Mackay's proposed reforms of the legal profession. Mere news of a half-day meeting at that time led to a flush of intemperate headlines that included "Rebel judges stop courts," and an MP with a gift for imagery announced, "Beneath the wigs and gowns, we have seen the feet of clay," if not the cloven hooves. Lord Wolfe's experience indicates the range of issues that may arise for the President. On the Constitutional Reform Bill, he played a typically strong hand, making only one false move, the celebrated reference to Lord Faulkner as the cheerful chappie, which caused a media firestorm and for which he immediately apologised. But take the example of the more prosaic kind of issue which will arise, or is likely to arise. The Criminal Justice Act 2003 made it easier for bad character evidence to be called against defendants. This was highly contentious, but it was passed. There was a date for its implementation in March 2005, and the Judicial Studies Board had a training course lined up for every single judge to take before that date. On the 25th of October, the Prime Minister announced that implementation would take place in December before that training had started. No coherent reason was advanced. There was speculation that a headline was needed on the day. A president asked to comment on such a decision why a parliamentary committee might find it difficult to resist, and a fired-up judge's counsel might be particularly incensed and pressing. Any adverse comment doesn't necessarily trespass against the separation of powers, but it will lift the senior judiciary into much greater prominence with the fourth estate, the media. So the Constitutional Reform Act may, therefore, lead to somewhat of a paradox. It will in time deprive serving judges of the opportunity to use their position in the legislature to promote their views. A future Lord Wolfe will be but Sir Harry. However, the President gains the responsibility to speak to Parliament as an outsider with potentially much greater visibility and perhaps less subtlety. Now, Justice supported the Constitutional Reform Act. It actually remains the only bill going through Parliament that I have been before, personally been before a parliamentary committee to support. However, there will be little benefit if it results, or there will be much less benefit than there could be, if it results in senior judicial figures getting more of the kind of verbal battering that can arise in the bear pit of politics. We might recall the report in the Sunday Times that a senior government minister thought to be Blunkett, I think we know they were right, was quoted as calling Wolfe a muddled old codger with an out-of-touch way. Lord Faulkner was particularly lucky that Lord Wolfe did not, as was reported he might, reside on the spot. Unless we're clear about the constitutional changes to come, this sort of disruptive row will erupt more often, and I'm concerned that it will be linked to a range of different matters that will be raised in the Human Rights Act. In this context, I think it is particularly regrettable that the opportunity wasn't taken to create a Ministry of Justice focused on matters relating to the legal system, as had been the almost universal demand of those who had campaigned for reform of this kind. Instead, we got a Department of Constitutional Affairs which took over a disparate range of matters from the Home Office, from electoral reform to House of Lords reform. It may be hard, therefore, for ministers to concentrate on core responsibilities for legal and judicial affairs. The justice system is surely important enough to have its own ministry with its own ministers. They don't need the distraction of a range of issues from the Channel Islands to electoral reform, which were essentially passed over to streamline the Home Office as a department focusing on criminal justice. An arguable consequence of the lack of such a focus is that by default, the Attorney General may actually emerge more as a voice within government arguing for the rule of law. Lord Goldsmith's speech in this series got press coverage last week precisely for his criticisms of Guantanamo Bay. As a practicing lawyer, the Attorney General may well have an affinity with lawyers that will be lacking for DCA ministers without such a background in the law. Yet the Attorney has other responsibilities for prosecution and advice to government, which may mean that the DCA's ministers would be structurally better in the longer term to take this role on without conflict. In the context of human rights, Lord Goldsmith ended his speech with a celebration of the newly elevated status of the law in public life, but warned against seeking to replace rule by Parliament by rule by lawyers. And I want specifically to address this in the context of my previous argument. The two seem to me to link. The Constitutional Reform Act implements a much greater formal separation of judicial, executive, and legislature. At the same time, the Human Rights Act potentially sets up a countervailing trend that increases a blurring between such powers. Interestingly, Dicey, who refuses to stay in an easy box, the great proponent of Parliament, acknowledged that the boundaries of sovereignty always were fuzzy, which I think is the word he actually used, and he gave the example of whether the Imperial Parliament, as he called it, could actually abolish Scotch law. Actual powers at their outermost limits are perhaps always difficult to define with precision, and partly that is, of course, because any constitutional balance of powers depends on writing, but much more and understanding, but much more on a degree of consensus. The Human Rights Act, strengthening as it does judicial review of executive and legislative action, exposes the judiciary in an unprecedented way. If lawyers and judges have largely accepted the concept of incorporation, the popular press has not. The Daily Express announced a verdict on asylum with the headline, "Who is running Britain, Mr. Blair? You should ask Mr. Justice Collins." And the Daily Mail has taken a similarly Dicean view. Unaccountable and unelected judges are openly and with increasing arrogance and perversity usurping the role of Parliament, setting the wishes of people at naught, and pursuing a liberal, politically correct agenda of their own. And there are other examples. Such hostility requires a response. We need to ask why the popular press is so hostile, and then whether we can do anything about it. Partly, the answer lies in the deep influence of a reductionist form of Dicean dualism on domestic culture, its rule of law and its parliamentary sovereignty. No matter that when Dicey talked of Parliament, he quite decidedly did not actually mean a party-dominated House of Commons. Nevertheless, the British public has a deep regard, born no doubt of several centuries of battle against the Crown, for parliamentary supremacy. The widespread cultural acceptance of the legitimacy of the House of Commons is precisely the reason, in one way, why the executive is able to exert such centralised control and is the problem that has held up reform of the House of Lords. Though it's interesting that this is emerging now as a political issue again. As a nation, we have been slow to accept the constitutional status of human rights. Lord Hoffman observed, actually before incorporation, what its effect would be. The courts of the United Kingdom, though acknowledging the sovereignty of Parliament, we'll come back to that, will apply principles of constitutionality little different from those which exist in countries where the power of the legislature is expressly limited by a constitutional document. That understanding has not penetrated public consciousness, and we need to develop a public understanding of the need for Dicey's dualism to be replaced by a new trinity: parliamentary sovereignty, the rule of law, and the protection of human rights, as set out for the moment at least in the European Convention of Human Rights, without regard to whether that threatens parliamentary sovereignty or not. And let me indicate from the Attorney's own speech the importance of so doing and of being so precise. He said, I have previously expressed the view that even when emergency or time of war permit some modification to or even derogation from certain rights, there are some rights so fundamental that there can be no compromise on them. Certain rights, for example, the right to life, the prohibition on torture, on slavery, are simply non-negotiable. Well, the right to life is contained in Article 2 of the European Convention, the prohibition on torture in 3, the prohibition on slavery on 4, the provision on derogation in 15. It's not surprising that the attorney has previously expressed the view that these are non-derogable rights. Add the principle of non-retrospectivity in Article 7, and he has repeated almost verbatim the full content of Article 15.2. That's not accidental. The convention was drafted by common lawyers in our Foreign Office. It is, in the words of Lord Steyne, a coherent, if ageing, charter of fundamental rights. I want to stress the coherence while acknowledging the ageing. Ministers should feel able to admit that we are subject to its provisions. They encode our own common law to a large extent and make more explicit their acceptance of the constitutional reform which they themselves instituted. In this context, we must also remember that incorporation was advanced only as an initial constitutional step, first by Charter 88 and then by the Labour Party itself. Its adoption was accompanied by none of the debate that surrounded the enactment of the Canadian Charter of Fundamental Rights and Freedoms in 1982, for example. There was, and there couldn't be, any debate about content. The very idea was that we took wholesale a convention originally drafted almost 50 years previously, hook, line and sinker. And thus we missed the full force of a debate about how the convention may be European in name, but reflects the domestic cultural values of the United Kingdom. The convention provided an easily digestible charter of rights, but has the disadvantages which we as lawyers, many of us, should remember. It's not transparent. The words of the convention are only a start. They've been significantly expanded by the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights. which declared the convention a living instrument and got to work on it. And the enormous weakness of it as a constitutional document is that, however attractive this might be to some of you in the audience and me, you need a lawyer or at least a very good and up-to-date textbook to understand it. Just take as one example the idea of proportionality that's been inferred by the European Court from words which do not use proportionality at all, necessary in a democratic society. Keir Starmer called this the defining characteristic of the Strasbourg approach to the protection of human rights, yet it's invisible in the text. And of course, as domestic case law grows, so there is an accretion of cases unremarked in the original text. And just look at the difficulty you would have in explaining to someone who is bound by this act in the first place and on what public authority Section 6 bites. We must admit that human rights are dangerously drifting away from accessibility, encouraging it to be the province, human rights to be the province of lawyers and not people, and that is a fundamental problem. We might note, though we would be unpopular, that the much derided European Charter of Fundamental Rights and Freedoms provides an example of one way of countering this. It's a summary in which detail has been sacrificed to clarity. Ultimately, and the issue may be when, the rights debate needs to move on to the need for such a readable and accessible charter or bill of rights. Such a charter would need, as does the European Charter, to take the European Convention as its base and build on it. In adopting a British model, we might take the European Charter, though that would be subject to enormous cultural resistance, or draft our own. But just contemplating this issue brought back old sermons with St. Augustine's plea. Let me repent, O Lord, but not yet. Let's work out a domestic bill of rights, but not quite yet. The process, which is necessary, would also create a morass into which legions and years could be lost. Practically, for the time being, we are stuck with the Convention as the best bill of rights we can practically have for all its problems, and we have to acknowledge those and work with them. The Convention inevitably raises the issue of the relationship of the judiciary and the legislative in the legislature in making law, and at the very limit, whether there are ways in which the very sovereignty of Parliament may be impugned. Judges have in recent times admitted to lawmaking ever since Lord Reed revealed that any other view was a fairy tale. But judgments required by the Human Rights Act, admittedly a statute duly passed by the legislature, get pretty close not only to making law, but declaring limits on Parliament's powers to do so. This is difficult territory for which it's difficult to find the right language, either, I think, as a lawyer, and certainly in public, for a public understanding. The notions of judicial deference have passed out of favour. I'm not sure that the coming language of discretionary area of judgment actually quite does it for a public audience, understandable though it may be for lawyers. But I agree with the kind of formulation that Lord Bingham gives, which I'll quote in a moment, but I don't think you can put it in a textbook for children, which is one test of a constitutional level understanding. Lord Bingham said, the more political, in a broad or narrow sense, a question is, the more appropriate it will be for political resolution, and the less likely it is to be an appropriate matter for judicial decision. The smaller, therefore, will be the potential role of the court. It's the function of political and not judicial bodies to resolve political questions. Conversely, the greater the legal content of any issue, the greater the potential role of the court, because under our constitution and subject to the sovereign power of Parliament, it's the function of courts and not political bodies to resolve legal questions. One issue for those interested in public understanding is how we communicate that. The intention of the government in passing the Human Rights Act was to mitigate the consequences of Lord Bingham's type of discrimination, distinction, through the power of a court to declare legislation incompatible with the Convention, but without any power to strike it down. Parliament would then decide whether it wanted to pay any attention or not. Among litigators, Section 4, which is the power to make a declaration was disparagingly referred to as the wooden spoon. It has, in the event, proved rather more valuable. The government has, as a matter of fact, honoured all declarations by re-legislating. Indeed, the political lesson of the legal decision in the Belmarsh case may be that the larger the implication of a court decision, the stronger the political imperative to replace the impugned provisions. It may be too soon to argue that this can amount to a constitutional convention. But the power to grant a declaration had always to be read in connection with the requirement on ministers to certify as compatible, which Lord Goldsmith commends, legislation compatible with the Human Rights Act, and also the overriding jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights, which he doesn't mention. A government minister certifies each bill as convention compliant. Thus, a judicial declaration to the contrary indicates on the face of it a ministerial misunderstanding. In theory, the government could sit it out and appeal to the European Court, or indeed seek to legislate without such a certification. That's quite possible. Such a formula upholds a fig leaf for parliamentary sovereignty in that it doesn't allow the court to nullify the legislation. However, the European Court's doctrine of margin of appreciation applies to national authorities, that is, decisions of governments as upheld by national courts. It's not carte blanche for governments to declare their own law. Signatories to the European Convention agree that decisions of the European Court are to be implemented under the supervision of the Council of Europe's Committee of Members. So the government is caught in a catch-22. Ministerial declaration that provisions incompatible will provide, one assumes, pretty conclusive grounds for any subsequent court, including Strasbourg, to accept that the government's right. It will then so rule. There's no way out of this. The European Court is effectively supranational because members of the Council of Europe agree to respect its decisions, albeit that the process of enforcement is not perfect and there may be delays and occasionally evasions. Thus, the Human Rights Act preserves parliamentary sovereignty, as we might say, with a twist. The government followed the Belmarsh case by presenting what became the Prevention of Terrorism Act 2005. The original legislation wasn't annulled by the court, but it fell de facto, if not de jure. Our limited experience to date is that the court can effectively force the executive to return to the legislature. It can't overturn the legislation itself. That seems to me a reasonable and indeed a desirable result. Replacement legislation will, of course, raise issues in its turn, as the 2005 legislation did, but that's avoidable, unavoidable. It's politics. So we're at a state, seems to me, which is unsatisfactorily theoretical, theoretically, practically advancing quickly, and one in which the judiciary have greater powers. You can't talk about judicial powers within the hallowed walls of London School of Economics without making reference to John Griffith, who towered over the law department for so long. He argued, at a time when this was a common view among trade unions and the left, that the judges were an unrepresentative conservative break on progressive change. Should we read about the changing composition of the US Supreme Court with some trepidation? Are we going that way? Though those likely to be automatically translated to the Supreme Court are people like Lady Hale of impeccable understanding and imagination, could we too find another generation of judges that might not be so sympathetic to human rights and to review of the executive? That's a risk, but I think it's an acceptable one. In the three decades since the last edition, I think, of John Griffith's book, which I think was 1991, much has changed. During two long periods of uninterrupted one-party government, the judiciary have developed core principles of review that are now supplemented by the Human Rights Act. That takes the judiciary into an overt constitutional role with transparent, if admittedly still evolving, principles, whereas John Griffith's thesis was that they had a covert one with none. At one level, a degree of tension between judiciary and executive is a sign of a healthy democracy. Just remember that the judiciary was symbolically among the Nuremberg, tried at Nuremberg for complicity with the regime. However, the kind of recuperative language used by the press suggests that such stresses can be destructive when not understood, explained, or accepted. We will need ultimately to define more precisely the role of the judiciary and the impact of human rights on the rule of law. Where we are now is completely unsatisfactory. For the moment, however, we might best take advantage of the flexibility that our unwritten constitution bequeaths and encourage as far as we can the new balance of powers to settle down with as little fuss as possible. Our prize is a changed balance in the constitution so that citizens can supplement the democratic accountability of those in public authority with a greater degree of legal accountability against democratic norms. That would be an enormous legacy for any government. But it does leave us in a somewhat unsatisfactory position. Government may threaten further legislation which changes that balance, as I began by quoting Mr. Blair saying. And supporters of human rights might fear it, although they would have to acknowledge that the current position is unsatisfactory and does require further statutory intervention in due course. This is unstable and illogical. Our hope has to be that familiarity will eventually breed consent and that the media, public, and politicians will gradually accept a rebalanced constitution. I began with a quote from the Prime Minister's press conference, "The rules are changing." I want to end by supplementing that with part of Bob Dylan's lyrics to "The Times They Are A-Changing," which actually only rhymes if you can speak it with a Midwest accent I'm not going to attempt. But come writers and critics who prophesy with your pen and keep your eyes open, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, the wheel's still in spin. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. You should have sung the last
chorus.
And now, Baroness Hale, I turn to you for your comments. Thanks.
Well, I'd first like to congratulate Roger Smith on a brilliant lecture. I think there's very little with which I can possibly disagree, apart from the absurdly flattering and obviously deeply ironic comments about myself. Until, of course, he got to the end. And then I'm not sure whether I do agree. But that's for discussion. I've got a few comments, footnotes, really. The first is, how much change with profound effects for the rule of law is the unforeseen and unintended consequence of things that seemed obvious and simple at the time? I could give two examples. The first is judicial review. My personal view is that the expansion of judicial review of administrative action has been the most profound change in the English legal system over my professional life. The comparison of the cases that come before us in the House of Lords now and the High Court and Court of Appeal, compared with the cases that came before the House of Lords in the 1950s and 1960s, shows this clearly. And this was the result of purely procedural changes that were recommended by the Law Commission in the 1970s, which produced a single procedure for all what had previously been the prerogative writs. And that enabled the courts to develop proper principles and got everybody very excited about the idea. And of course, then the culture had been reining back government, and it wouldn't have been foreseen that you could start to use judicial review to force local authorities to provide you with services and housing and so on. But that's what eventually happened. All completely unforeseen. Second example of something unforeseen is the effect of the constitutional reforms that were announced on the 12th of June 2003. These must have seemed obvious to the administrators who dreamt them up at the time. There'd been calls for an independent judicial appointments commission for ages, not so much to separate judicial appointments from government, but actually to improve the transparency and fairness of the appointment system in the hope that it would result in a more diverse judiciary. That's what it was about. But everybody thought it was obvious. There were calls from influential quarters for setting up a United Kingdom Supreme Court. not just physically separate across Parliament Square, and not in a new building, Roger.
Newly refurbished.
I have to say that some of my colleagues very, very much want us to have a nice, spanking new building, and deeply regret that we're going into a rather older one. Some of us, on the other hand, have to confess a sneaking and developing liking for the rather older one to which we're going to go. That may be making the best of a bad job, I know not. And of course the other thing on which there was general agreement was that the judicial role of the Lord Chancellor could no longer be justified. So all three of those things seemed absolutely obvious. What hadn't occurred to anybody until Lord Wolfe pointed it out was that it meant that the Lord Chancellor could no longer be head of the judiciaries of England and Wales and Northern Ireland. He'd never been head of the judiciary in Scotland, of course. And probably in practice, as Roger has been pointing out, that's probably the most profound change that will result from the Constitutional Reform Act. They also won't have foreseen the furore that there was about the role of the Lord Chancellor in protecting the rule of law and the independence of the judiciary within government. This isn't surprising, is it? Where else but in the United Kingdom would the abolition of the position where the head of the judiciary was also a senior member of the government be seen as a threat to the independence of the judiciary? It's quite extraordinary, paradoxical, that we should see it as such, but we did. I've got a piece here about Roger's shopping list and whether I agreed with it, and I did, but then he deleted the shopping list from his paper, so I can't say anything very much about the shopping list. I do agree with him, from my experience as a law reformer, that it might or might not be a very good thing to have our own homegrown Bill of Rights or our own homegrown constitution. It might, in theory, but I have grave doubts about whether it would ever happen, and if it did happen, whether any of us would actually like the results. And I say that from my experience of trying to promote wholesale law reform at the Law Commission. It's very difficult to do, especially in politically contentious areas. I don't say that it can't constitutionally be done. There is a view that the most profound decision of the House of Lords in relation to the rule of law recently is not the Belmarsh decision at all. In Belmarsh, we were only doing, to the best of our ability, and not, of course, to universal acclaim, the task which Parliament had undoubtedly set for us through the combination of the Human Rights Act and the Anti-Terrorism Act itself. The more profound decision could arguably be the decision in Jackson and the Attorney General, the Hunting Act case. And the reason for that is it was held that the legality of an Act of Parliament was justiciable. In the Court of Appeal, though not in the House of Lords, it was held that there were limits to what could be done using the Parliament Act, which were not derived from the terms of the Parliament Act itself. They were determined from general principles about what was and was not within the competence of Parliament. The majority of the House of Lords, all of the House of Lords rejected that, but the majority of the House of Lords did observe, although obiter, that there was a limit to what could be done under the Parliament Acts, that they could not be used to prolong the life of a Parliament, even by the two-stage procedure of repealing the prohibition in the Act and then prolonging it. And there are various other observations in that case, which law students will have great fun playing with, won't they, in their constitutional law courses for a long time to come. But they are about how you legislate, how Parliament could bind itself as to how it legislated, and to some extent about what you can do by legislation. For example, set yourself the question, what would Lord Hope think of an attempt to abolish Scotch law? I have very little doubt about what Lord Hope would think about that. So there are profound things going on. But the interesting thing, of course, about the Hunting Act case was that we had to make the decision because there was somebody who asked us to. This is where judges stand in the system. We don't dream up these cases for ourselves. We don't invent them and then pronounce We decide the cases that parties put before us. And once somebody has put a case before us, we have to deal with it as best we can. We can't ignore it or duck it. We've got no choice. There's a provision in the French Civil Code, which I won't try and say in French because my French accent is probably worse than your Bob Dylan accent. But what it says is, the judge who refuses to judge on the ground of the silence, the obscurity, or the insufficiency of the law may be proceeded against as to blame for the denial of justice. So that's where judges stand in relation to the rule of law. We have to make it up as we go along. Thank you.
Thank you both very much for two very profound discussions of the issue. Some contentious issues, I think, were raised. So we have now about 20 minutes or so for comments, discussion, questions from all of you. Could you first please say who you are? And we'll take some comments and questions, discussion in sort of clusters and then come back to the speakers to respond to them. And could you try and keep your questions fairly concise so as to allow as many people as possible to be able to contribute to the discussion? So who'd like to start? There's a microphone coming. Yeah.
Thank you. Stephen Hockman. Can I pick up where Lady Hale left off? What she was really dealing with, I think, is the question of whether there are any limits, and if so, what they are, on parliamentary sovereignty, on the ability of Parliament to legislate exactly as it wishes. And just offer a couple of more examples on which people might care to comment. One is the possibility of Parliament conferring powers on the executive but excluding the right of the citizen judicially to review them. That possibility certainly exists, and in relation, I think, to some immigration or asylum powers 2 or 3 years ago, there was a bill which might have had that effect if it had gone through. The other possibility is that Parliament confers on the executive the power to make or at least to amend legislation without going through the full parliamentary process. That possibility exists too, because it forms part of a bill which is getting off the stocks at the moment. Now, this is not intended to be anything other than a politically neutral point, because such situations could arise under any government. But the question is, what, if anything, our constitution offers by way of commentary on those possibilities?
Thank you. Who would like to go next? Yep.
Katie Ghosh, the British Institute of Human Rights. I welcome what I think, Roger, was your conclusion at the end, sort of reining back perhaps slightly from going down a full-blown sort of calling for a Bill of Rights sort of immediately, and I think that was something that Lady Hale said. There's a danger, of course, that if you want something absolutely great and homegrown, that you might not get sort of what your ambitions were. So I'd welcome that, and the reason I welcome that is I think we have to bear in mind that the Human Rights Act is still a new law. It's only been in for about 5 years in force, and it's still bedding down. What's crucial about the Human Rights Act is that the intention behind it was not to have lots of legal challenges. When the Human Rights Act is working really well, it's individuals on the ground who get appalling treatment from public services and are put in terrible situations who challenge that. And when it's working well, it's local authorities who are using human rights values and principles in their policies and procedures so that they make the decision right the first time round, and they don't separate old elderly couples who are very frail and make them go into different care homes. That's when it works well. Of course, you have the law there as a backstop, but actually the Human Rights Act is a different kind of law. And I just think we have to bear in mind that in mind when we start talking about revisiting it. And I would slightly take issue, I think, Roger, I think it's a very interesting point in terms of the constitutional settlement, but I don't think it's the only reason that we've had quite sort of vitriolic press coverage is the kind of constitutional aspects of the Act is also partly just because we're not yet familiarised in this country with the value of human rights to ordinary people in their everyday lives. And it's hardly surprising, really, when all you hear about is prisoners abroad or terror suspects at home. So I absolutely take on board the constitutional aspects, but I just think we have to look at the broader picture. The Human Rights Act is a fantastic tool on the ground, and let's keep working, you know, as my organisation is, to kind of keep it that way and actually helping individuals who need it most.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'll agree with Vaughan Williams. This is something very much into the future because in the case of Wales, there's the proposed bill working its way through. How might, in the future, the effect of the law and human rights and all the other matters affect the Scottish Parliament and the Wales Government Assembly? Sorry, the Wales Assembly Government.
Okay, we'll take one more and then come back to the speakers.
So. My name is Barbara Jorelli Kent. May I ask the panel why, in their view, the government, in fact, has decided somehow to relinquish the powers of the judiciary that obviously is going to affect this country long term? And point number two, why in their view was the Human Rights Act introduced in the first place? Why was it introduced? Because if you think about it, I don't want to go too deep or too sort of controversial here, but when one is speaking about prisoners locked up and torture and this sort of thing, which as an English person disgusts me, that torture should take place at all, the Human Rights Act, in my view, doesn't appear to be strong enough to stop it.
Thank you.
Can you see the point I'm making? I mean, if it was such a strong law, it should be stopped immediately, so as to speak. I mean, this shouldn't have gone on for so long. I mean, it's very controversial, there are fors and against to this, but it makes one think, in such a civilised country, why the Human Rights Act had to be introduced in the first place. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Who would like to go first?
If we begin with the end, why was it introduced? I think that's, probably don't want to go there, although we might just go back to an article that Tony Blair published on Sunday in The Observer. And you might have noticed that Gordon Brown was out in The Guardian on Monday defending the government against charges of authoritarianism. And Tony Blair begins by, quite rightly, praising the constitutional agenda with which his government began. And I think it was a genuine attempt, thought through in opposition during, and I think only a party that was out of power for so long and was so far from power would have had the time and the inclination to look at constitutional matters with the attention that the Labour Party did. Beginning extolling that human rights commitment and the constitutional reform, and then using as a bridging argument a sort of reference to Benthamite, the greatest good of the greatest number, and then moving to a defence of Asbos and so on. So I think that the point I'm making, I think, is that Labour took on this constitutional agenda and hasn't really thought it through in the way that I think Lord Goldsmith should have acknowledged that he was quoting from the European Convention in his speech when he was talking about the constraints on derogation. I think there's a failure by ministers to think it through properly. In terms of the limits on parliamentary sovereignty, and Stephen asked that, of course, that's a really hot issue. Judges are the more willing to speak about the limits as enforceable to the extent that they are retired. And Lord Donaldson was particularly strong. I remember some quote in relation to the Ouster Clause, if they do that, we will have no option but to say they can't. No serving judge that I know ever goes as far as that. As you will know, various judges in academic speeches, I think not least Lord Wolfe himself in the early 90s, have suggested there were limits to parliamentary sovereignty, which he hasn't found the opportunity to explore in judgments. So it's clearly a very difficult issue. There clearly are, I mean, I think it's absolutely fascinating because there clearly are limits. I mean, if Parliament declared, government declared it wasn't going to, there is an obvious limit. If it declared there were going to be no more elections. And I think it's interesting for lawyers. I think it's interesting it comes before the courts and in cases like the fox hunting case, interesting that it'll be studied by students. As Lady Hale was saying, I don't think there's any easy answer to that. It's a very sort of uncertain area. I'm not sure why there's... I think there's vitriolic press coverage for a variety of reasons, some of which I think are quite unsavoury. I think the press doesn't like the idea that it might be a right of privacy if in the human right, through a human rights approach, and it's deliberately staked out a position against that. Will devolution make have an effect? Yes, an enormous effect. You can already see the effect. You can see the political effect of that as Herceptin is prescribed in Scotland and not in England, as a different positions are taken on human rights, and there's a Human Rights Commission in Scotland, a different position in Northern Ireland. So you can see the political consequences of that, and if I'm right, one of Dicey's great points is that we don't have devolution issues in a federation. So that we're not a federation, and so one of the things that allows us to uphold the state as he saw it out of it was the fact we quite precisely weren't a federal jurisdiction with a, therefore, a court that had to take the ultimate devolution decision. So I think devolution is a very critical issue to which I'm quite sure that we will come back. But the thing, I think there's agreement that there is no great push at the moment for, this is my final point, no great push at the moment, and I'm conscious that I'm not arguing against anybody much in arguing that we shouldn't go down the road of a written Bill of Rights, a written constitution. But there is the paradox, which I think we have to acknowledge, that it is profoundly unsatisfactory where we are. That not to be able, and it's, the distinction for me is really made by the European Charter of Fundamental Rights and Freedoms, for all the derision that it gets. The European Commission produced that in a little stamp-sized document for school kids to take away, and you can read it and understand it, what it's about. It doesn't include the publication of the European Commission, a whole series of horizontal clauses that Lord Goldsmith saw through at the back, which limit its effect, but it's readable. And it gives you a good indication. Now, all sorts of, I can see Carol tensing in her chair. There are all sorts of objections to the European Charter as a justiciable document. And I'd be surprised if somebody doesn't bring them up, but I'm going to bait this audience a little more, Carol in particular. I think it's very readable and it's understandable, and I think that's really important. That's a major problem, and it's a major reason, I think, why the human rights, a major weakness of the Human Rights Act, that makes it a playground for lawyers, because if you're not a lawyer, it's really hard to understand. Not a satisfactory document, but it is what we've got.
I'm not sure how many of these points I really can comment on. I don't suppose Stephen really wants me to respond to the...
I'd love you to.
Parliamentary sovereignty? No, because he might want to argue one of them, then he wouldn't want me to recuse myself from the case, would you? No, I think I'm not going to make any further comment about that. I would like to make a comment on the devolution point, because what becomes clear sitting where I do, in not only the House of Lords but also the Privy Council, is that when devolution issues come from Scotland to the Privy Council, and they will in future go to the Supreme Court, the Privy Council is, for the first time really within the United Kingdom in recent years, acting like a true constitutional court, the Supreme Court of a federation, not just deciding what is the internal law applicable to the particular case. And that is and we can judicially review the acts not only of the Scottish Executive but also of the Scottish Assembly. So it gets us into the same sort of position that the Privy Council has been in for the Commonwealth jurisdictions, as it's always had, but it's a new one. It wasn't with Ireland, of course, that was also the case to some extent with Ireland, but it's become much more apparent. And I think that adds to all that string of things in the air that are changing the nature of what the highest court in the country does.
Now, I mentioned judicial review. There's also the European Union, there's the Human Rights Act, and there's devolution. I think those are four developments which are changing the way in which we think and act. I'd like just to congratulate the British Institute of Human Rights, because they at least have realised that the importance of human rights is something that should be seen on the ground for people every day, and that wonderful piece of work called Something for Everyone, which... And of course the mission is to try and get it over... This is Roger's point, isn't it? The mission is to try and get it over to people that human rights are actually for people. They're not for the courts and for lawyers. We don't want to have to tell people that they've been acting incompatibly with people's human rights. We just would like them to act compatibly. And that's what we've got to try and get over. So I agree with you and I congratulate you.
All right, I think we're probably about two or three more, yeah. So they're fairly brief questions, please.
Yes, Richard Dufresne, Director of the College of Law. Roger, can I just take up on your conclusion that we're in a profoundly unsatisfactory position? Isn't it at least arguable we're in a profoundly satisfactory position, exactly where we would have thought we ought to be around this time, 5 or 6 years into a major series of major constitutional changes, which have empowered the judges and given them a vast range of new, in a sense, new powers that they didn't have before? In other words, we are at a stage where we're actively debating these issues. What are the powers of the judges, as opposed to Parliament? I'm delighted the Daily Express and the Daily Mail are taking the positions they are, because that, in fact, is part of that debate. That debate. I'm rather surprised to hear that you are pessimistic about the extent to which human rights has gone beyond understanding, has gone beyond the sort of the charm circle of lawyers and judges. I mean, my impression is that it is now pervasive. People are asserting, often quite erroneously, that they have a human right to this and a human right to that, all over the place. And we are exactly where one might have hoped one would be. In fact, much further on in developing a truly sort of liberal, open, liberal, constitutional and political order of a kind that this country has been searching for since the constitutional settlement of the 1680s.
Thank you. Emma Douglas, LLM student. It's a question more for Baroness Hale. I'm wondering if there's been any feeling amongst senior judiciary that the judiciary itself should perhaps be given the resources to run the court system completely independently, in order to have a true separation of powers and a completely independent court system. And even if the judiciary doesn't currently have the means by which to do this, do you think it's perhaps a longer term goal for constitutional reform, given that, as Roger touched on, the DCA is often seen by some as an offshoot of the Home Office, and perhaps a more radical approach might be better for the independence of the judiciary.
Thank you.
I think we'll start with you.
Shall I start with answering the question that was addressed to me? Well, I won't, of course, answer it properly for you, because there is a debate, because there are other court systems around the world which are presented with their own budget, and they then run that budget. And they run it for themselves, and it's all under the control of the judges. It would take us a very long time to get there, because actually running things is jolly hard. And most judges like judging. And they regard running things as very much a spare time activity. I'm a member of the Judges' Council, in fact, and I could expatiate on that, but I won't. This has two meetings a term for about an hour and a half after court, which is not the easiest of fora in which to deliberate important issues or get genuinely representative views from the judiciary. And a lot of very busy judges are doing a lot of more administration than they used to do, but actually being responsible for the whole shebang would require something completely different. So I'm sceptical about whether it will happen, let alone whether it will be a good thing. But the other point is, how do you square that with accountability for public expenditure? Because there has to be accountability for public expenditure. This is one of the arguments that was made for abolishing the position of the Lord Chancellor during the constitutional reform debate. And in fact, it was made by a former Attorney General. who is now a member of the House of Lords, who said he had never understood why it was appropriate for a major spending minister like the Lord Chancellor to be in the House of Lords. The Lord Chancellor spends a great deal of public money, and he should be accountable to, in the same way as any other big spending minister is, to the House of Commons for that. These are difficult things to get straight, in other words. So let's see how the new dispensation with the Lord Chief Justice running more things than he used to. Ideally, I'm quite sure the judges would like to be in complete charge of their own budgets, but in practice...
Let me just come back to Richard's point, which in a way sums up what I was trying to say. There was a time when I was reading articles and they were all subtitled with a quote that allegedly comes from Dickens: it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And I think the problem at the moment, the difficulty at the moment, is the hope at the moment is we can see the mountain, and you can see where you want to go, and the road leads up. We can see the path, and you can see a way forward in which the British Constitution evolves in a really exciting way, in a way that wasn't possible for 1997, the reforms that came in there. And that is a genuine major achievement of this government, to open up that route. And that is about a rebalancing constitution, it's about giving power, and it's all tangled and all the rest of it. And yes, of course it would be, but we can see a route that wasn't available before. On the other hand, I think the other side of that is there's too much in play, is my fear. That the Constitutional Reform Act reforms make things clear, which I believe in, I mean, and supported, shift the roles around so that the judiciary is much more exposed, and tensions, I think, which are going to be much more evident. The Human Rights Act was always an adventure, and we've gone on the road. The thing we weren't expecting, this thing came into force on the 2nd of October, 2000, of course, what we weren't expecting was 9/11, 2001. And we could have anticipated problems of the Human Rights Act in relation to life sentences and criminal justice. We could have anticipated problems in relation to asylum seekers. We could never have anticipated the enormous pressure of the 2001 Act, of which the House of Lords, which Lady Hale was a member, made a courageous decision, which may not be as important as Jackson, but it's pretty good. And I'd actually say it's more important, but it was a pretty courageous decision. And I think pretty courageous and major. But under massive tensions, and judiciary courageous, taking politicians under enormous pressure. And you don't want to minimise the pressure on a Home Secretary or a Prime Minister. They're the ones with responsibility when things go off. So, and the response to terrorism, that is something which no British Prime Minister has had to deal with previously. So what we got unexpectedly, as we started on a road down a country lane, was the 747 kind of landed, crash next door, and everything. And my fear is that it's all too much in play. And you wouldn't, of course, have planned it this way, but then, hey, what would you have planned?
And on that note, remains for me just to thank you both very much again for making this third of the series extremely successful, very memorable, I think, as well. So thank you both very much again.